Okay.
15, 20 seconds, I think. Okay. Yeah.
Well, you know, so Penny has told you about a tool in our arsenal that's just recently been released, and Tony has told you about a tool in our arsenal that is in process. What I'm going to talk to you about is a tool that has been in existence now for about 8 years, and that is the community, what we call the Community Guide Recommendations for Community-Based Interventions. I should also mention that this is, I'm abbreviating, which is usually about a 90-minute talk, so I'm going to talk pretty fast. And I'm going to start with asking how many people are familiar with the Community Guide Recommendations, like really familiar with them? Okay, how many people sort of know what they are? And this is not a test, so be honest. How many of you really don't know what they are? Okay, for you folks, I'm going to apologize in advance for the brief descriptions I'm going to give of these, and I'm going to tell you that after the session, if you have questions about these, to just grab me, or you can email me at jepping@cdc.gov. There's also a website I'm going to show you up here. Okay. Oh, and I have no relationships to disclose.
Except with your dogs.
Right, except with my dogs. So we'll start with what is the Community Guide. It's a tool for evidence-based public health practice, and it's a set of recommendations. These recommendations are built upon a systematic review of the evidence in the same way that the review was conducted for what resulted in the physical activity guidelines. It's just that these are reviews of interventions to promote physical activity. They are population-based strategies as opposed to clinical strategies. It's a Department of Health and Human Services initiative, and we at CDC provide staff support. Then the recommendations are actually made by an independent task force on community preventive services. There are three major categories, or domains, if you will, in which these recommendations fall. And as you see them here, I'm going to begin with describing the informational approaches. One of the informational approaches is community-wide campaigns. And community-wide campaigns, in a way, are self-descriptive in that they involve a number of components. A major component is media, but it's not the only component. So in a community-wide campaign, you may have newspaper, radio, billboards, signs on buses, etc. But you'll also have different initiatives and different activities throughout the community. So you may have health screening. You may have group walks and so on. So it's highly visible, and it is usually a longer-term activity. So these are not one-day events. Most of them last from several weeks to years. The next is point of decision prompts, and these are simply signs that are placed near elevators or escalators to encourage people to use the stairs instead. And incidentally, we've used that strategy in the building in which I work at CDC, and I'm not going to show you the pictures of those, but our stairways look like the typical stairways in most buildings, dark, unattractive, hard to find, and so on. So we actually did a little intervention in our building, and they started with carpeting the stairs, and we put the infrared sensors on the doors on each floor. So we were actually able to see, as additional enhancements were added, what it did to stair use. So first they carpeted the stairs, then they painted the walls. Then they put art on the walls, beautiful art, and it's been rotated once or twice. So once they put art, for example, that children of CDC employees had designed, and then finally they added music, and you can actually listen to a different genre of music every day of the week. And it did increase stair use in the building. It wasn't a large increase. I think it was about 18% initially, and then, of course, over time, it dropped back down, but it still remained above baseline. The next informational approach are mass media campaigns, and this is strictly mass media. To, you know, raise people's awareness, to influence their efficacy for being active. So sort of, sort of awareness, knowledge, intention are attempted to be influenced through mass media. And the final, and I should mention that these are the approaches that were reviewed. I'm going to show you of these which ultimately resulted in recommendations, because not all of them did. So classroom-based health education is another informational approach, and that is also pretty much what it sounds like. These are classroom attempts to educate children about the benefits of physical activity. They were usually combined with other behaviors, so nutrition might have been part of that as well. And they included behavioral strategies, teaching kids how to do decision-making, goal-setting, relapse prevention, getting social support, giving social support, that kind of thing. So to summarize in informational approaches, these approaches could receive these following levels of recommendation: either recommended with strong evidence, recommended with sufficient evidence, not recommended, and not recommended is usually, well, and insufficient evidence. The insufficient evidence does not mean not recommended. It just means that at the time of the review, there wasn't enough evidence from which to make a recommendation. And then another possibility is recommended against, and that would usually be due to harms, mainly due to harms, actually. So the community-wide campaigns were recommended with strong evidence, recommended with sufficient evidence, excuse me, was point of decision prompts, and mass media campaigns didn't have enough evidence at the time to generate a recommendation, nor did classroom-based health education. So the thing to remember from this is community-wide campaigns and point of decision prompts. The next category is behavioral and social approaches, and I might mention that if you look at these levels of approaches, sort of bass-ackwards, they broadly will remind you of the social-ecological model. So in behavioral and social approaches, the interventions that were looked at were school-based physical education curricula and policy, and these were physical education programs or initiatives that try to increase the amount of moderate to vigorous physical activity in which students engage during class. And they involved policy in that one of the approaches might be to add PE classes to the number that existed over the course of a week, for example, to make existing classes longer than they were, or to increase the amount, the proportion of time that students were active during class. And that is more a curricular approach. So some examples were making, entrance time and exit time to and from the gym active. Had to do with taking large-sided games, excuse me, like softball. This is an example I'll use. Traditional softball games have 9 people sitting on the bench, or 8 people sitting on the bench, 1 person at bat. The outfield has that many people, especially young children, who are laying there looking at the clouds or, whatever, picking their nose. And there's not inherently there's not a lot of physical activity in that game, especially for, again, young kids who haven't really developed the skills to play. So you take a game like that and you make it all run softball. And here are some of the differences. There are several fielders, maybe five of the fielders, who are identified by a colored penny, for example. When a ball is hit, that ball has to be thrown to each of those identified fielders before it can be thrown in for the out. So you have at least six kids, actually you have at least seven kids who have to, you know, catch and throw a ball. In the meantime, the entire batting team is running the bases until the ball is thrown in for the out. So that's an example of taking a large-sided game and making it smaller. And then you can take other games that don't inherently have as much physical activity and make them. Another is this isn't really inherently inactive. Well, let me use an example. In elementary school, especially in young grades, do you remember a game called Duck, Duck, Goose? Right. So what was that? Everybody sat in a big circle and two kids chased each other, you know, around the circle. Or musical chairs, where, you know, one at a time people were eliminated. Or one of my favorites in the Hall of Shame is dodgeball, you know, where the unskilled children were first out and we were using children as targets, for example. So those kinds of games are either eliminated in this curricula or they're modified. So let's take musical chairs, and I'll make this my last example. We'll play musical hoops. So I throw out 15 or 20 hoops, or maybe 35 hoops if I have a class of 70 elementary kids, and we start the music, and when the music stops, their job is simply to get in a hoop. They do that, I pick up a couple of the hoops. The music starts again. When the music stops, their job is still to get in a hoop. It doesn't matter if it's with someone else. And this continues until in a normal class, I have maybe two hoops left out, and the children have to learn how to coordinate and cooperate, for one thing, to have everyone's foot in the hoop. No one is out. Everyone's active the whole game. So those are very specific examples of how you can increase the amount of time within PE. And I worked with one of those programs, which is why I talking about it so much. It was a child and adolescent trial for cardiovascular health, or known as the CATCH study. And our goal was just to raise the activity to 40% of time, and we actually raised it to 50% of class time. Absolutely not a lot of time, because the whole class time in most cases is 30 minutes. So moving along. Individually adapted health behavior change was another strategy that was looked at, and that had to do, in a lot of cases, with using the stages of change or trans-theoretical model to move people along. So you sort of started where they were, not thinking about it at all, kind of thinking about it, preparing to do it, doing it, or relapsing. Social support in community settings was another strategy that was examined, and that used either built on existing social communities, or it built them in order to get individuals to be more active. So these interventions utilized strategies like buddy systems, contracting, and walking clubs. And I, you know, in my support of dog walking, I think that's a level of social support, though it's family social support. And college-based health education and PE was another strategy. And this was a combination of health ed classes, and then it sort of, you know, a lot of that taking place in the gym. And classroom-based health education to reduce TV viewing and video playing, which is pretty self-explanatory, but a lot of these studies also had components that were utilized at home. So, for example, there were TV turn-off times, and there were instruments that parents could use to actually lock the TV. So it did reduce the TV watching time in that case. And family-based social support, which would use similar strategies to community-based, but within the family, modeling for children, participating in activity together, that sort of thing. Here's what happened. School-based PE curriculum policy is recommended with strong evidence. So is individually adapted health behavior change. And so are social support interventions in community settings. There was insufficient evidence to recommend college-based health education and PE and classroom-based health education to reduce screen time. Now, interestingly, our division just conducted a review and looked at the same strategy with respect to obesity, and physical activity was one of the outcomes that they considered, and they came to the same finding in terms of physical activity. So it's sort of been confirmed. And family-based social support. The final domain includes environmental and policy approaches, and I hope that this will get some to the young lady's question earlier about, you know, being able to support at sort of macro levels individual choices. One of those is, and this is a long title, but you're going to know why in a minute, creation of and/or enhanced access to places for physical activity combined with informational outreach. The reason it's long is because every component of this intervention is important. In other words, if you build it, they do not necessarily come. But if you build it and you let them know about it and you create reasons for them to come, like incentives, like activities, structured activities that are there, then they do come. Community scale urban design and land use is another strategy that was looked at. And think of this at sort of the macro level. So these are strategies that use things like building policies, policies to slow traffic down, to I don't know if discourage is actually the right word, but let's say to encourage use of public transit. So they use things like, well, take an example of a downtown area that has some type of a retail establishment on the ground floor, and then there are living quarters above that. There are grid designs in the streets so that it makes it easy to walk from location to location rather than having to swing around the long way to get there and so on. So mixed use, mixed land use, zoning, encouraging public transit and so on. Street scale urban design and land use essentially does the same thing, but in a smaller geographic area. So think of a few blocks, an area of a few blocks. So this will use things like easily visible crosswalks, pedestrian signs, sidewalks, maybe aesthetic enhancements to the street that make them more attractive for people to walk on. And the final is transportation policies and practices. And these have may have a variety of strategies. The number of studies that were pulled were small, and there actually only was one study that met the ultimate criteria for being included. But these would utilize strategies like roadway designs that would build bike lanes onto them, putting bike racks on buses and the like, enhancing the amount of transportation. And here's what happened with those. Increased access is recommended with strong evidence. Community-scale urban design and street-scale urban design are recommended with sufficient evidence. And as you can guess, there wasn't enough evidence to make a recommendation on transportation policies and practices. So here it is in summary. Strong evidence for school-based PE, individually adapted health behavior change, community social support, enhanced access, and community-wide campaigns. Sufficient evidence is point of decision prompts, community and street scale, urban design, and land use. So there you have 8 strategies that have been shown to be effective. We don't yet have enough evidence, or they didn't then, for mass media, classroom health ed, college health ed PE, reducing TV watching, family social support, and transportation. As Steve mentioned, we are in the early stages of a process now to actually update these recommendations. It's been 8 years since they've come out. A great deal of research has occurred from that. And we just last week presented a proposal to the U.S. Task Force that was approved. So we're going to be moving forward with that review. And here are some websites where you can get additional information about the strategies, about the task force, the publications that have been issued as a result of this. And I think, let me go back to that.
Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you.
We'll take a couple of specific questions for Jackie, and then I have a question for the panel, perhaps. Are there any questions for Jackie that someone would like to ask? Right.
How did you promote your Carol project? You mentioned that you built it, but they built it, and you haven't promoted it, so
it's published, and several buildings at CDC actually have also begun the process of stairwell enhancement. We have these recommendations generally have been promoted widely via the
stair use at CDC.
Oh right. So are you asking me how did we publicize it specifically at CDC?
How did you promote it? You did the changes, but how did you promote it to the employees?
How did you let them know?
It was there. I mean, there were signs by the elevator that said stairs that way. There was a sign by the snack bar on the first floor, which is actually conveniently also located several yards from the elevators, that said, now that you have, replenished your caloric intake, and there were signs actually at various levels on the stairwell that said, you've burned this many calories. Now, one of the strategies that was not effective were signs that were placed in the bathrooms, stall walkers, and some folks just felt like that invaded their privacy too much. But it was primarily through the places of signs.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me? Yeah, stall talker, I'm sorry. Yeah, which are signs that are actually placed on the door inside of the bathroom stalls. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I was just interested in how you got the fire marshal to approve putting carpet on the stairwell. We tried that in California and got shot down. Just to make a rhetorical point, that there's some building challenges to make those kinds of improvements in stairwells.
Yes, there are. Not only that, but who does the painting?
Right.
what liability issues there might be, and so on. So it, depending on where you are, some people have been able to implement it fairly readily. Other places, it's not, you don't get the bang for your buck in doing it, and you want to look at another strategy. By the way, I think I'd like to mention that in the ideal world, you would utilize strategies at all of these levels to really be successful. If you have to pick among the levels and you're able to work at the higher environmental and policy levels, that's where you're going to have the greatest reach. Those, however, are the most expensive, take the longest time, and are more difficult to measure the outcomes from. So you really have to look at what your resources are. Besides the scientific evidence, you have to look at what's feasible for you, what reach you might have, how adaptable and adoptable these strategies might be to the communities in which you work. And finally, Tony mentioned in terms of the national plan, how sustainable they might be, how likely it is that they'll be able to live on after you and your funding are gone.
Thank you, Jackie. We have a few minutes left in this session, so just in closing, I'm going to ask a question. So we've looked at what we have available to us, so what I want to ask is perhaps what are we lacking or what are we missing? You know, what gaps might we need to fill to give so one thing that you think we might need to tackle in the future? Penny?
I wanted to mention that some of the things that Jackie mentioned are in the guideline document. So we were trying to decide, is it chapter 6 or chapter 8? Anyway, this is what I want to leave you with. We are not finished. The first ever physical activity guidelines for Americans have been released, but there is nothing in place to give these guidelines sustainability. In other words, there is no mechanism that will cause the United States Department of Health and Human Services to reissue guidelines on a regular basis as the science evolved. So then, if I'm not there in 5 years, who's going to go banging on the secretary's door? Supposing we've got a very unbelievable person who I'm sure will take my place, but the secretary's not quite convinced. We have some work to do to give the physical activity guidelines the same sustainability that the dietary guidelines for Americans have. So we've done it, but we're not home free yet. There have been two bills proposed, one in the Senate and one in the House, and they've gone nowhere. So both the Senate and the House introduced bipartisan bills, but as they tell me, there was no mechanism to get these bills on the way. So don't stop working on that.
Okay.
Thank you. That's my one thing.
Can we come up and just give a comment?
Well, in terms of gaps in knowledge about community-based interventions, you know, we can begin with the strategies that have already been identified for which there was insufficient evidence when these guidelines were originally recommended. And of course, that's one of the things that we're going to look at. These guidelines are developed through a mechanism of a coordinating committee of experts in the field and CDC staff. And one of the first questions that we had to ask when we started thinking about this update process is, where are the gaps? And these headings that I just showed you, these intervention strategies were arbitrarily identified. In other words, as they sorted through the evidence, they sort of put these in piles or bins, depending on how much alike they tended to be. At another point of time, those bins might have been entirely different. So we suspect that there are other kinds of strategies that may emerge as we look at the evidence. For example, a similar review was recently done in Latin America and identified three strategies that were not in the community guide recommendations: community-based classes, short messaging, and something that they called think of it as a combination of community-wide campaigns and these environmental and these transportation strategies all put in one. We kind of suspect that there might be a genre that has to do with technology interventions to promote physical activity, but there are still a lot of gaps in the intervention research, and we're hoping that our update will at least begin to address some of those.
Well, I think this kind of follows on Jackie's discussion of the community guide, but one of the things that a lot of us were frustrated by in the Physical Activity Guidelines Advisory Committee is that we were not allowed to discuss the implementation issues. We weren't allowed at all to go beyond how much is needed, for what purposes, you know, and what populations and so forth. So I think one of the frustrations that a number of us have is that, again, you can come out with guidelines, or not guidelines, you can come out with recommended interventions that may work in the population as a whole, but it doesn't work in certain subpopulations. And let me just give you an example. For the stair prompts, as of a couple of years ago, out of the probably 20 or 25 studies, there was only one that did subgroup analyses by ethnicity. And in that particular study, it was Anderson et al., 1998, in that particular study, the intervention did not work in African Americans. So basically, we have a best practice that in the paltry evidence available doesn't seem to work. Now, you don't know whether it doesn't work because of the way it's promoted or whether it's something inherently, you know, based on the intervention. And based on a second study that same group did that was published in 2006, it seems as if it was the promotion, because they changed out the sign, and when they put a sign of an African-American woman on these stairs, not only did African-Americans then respond and have the same effect size as whites, but the whites still responded just as well. So I think that, you know, and we also have a project that we just finished some of the data analyses on in the downtown Caltrans building, which was a natural experiment in which an innovative architectural design created stairs that had ambient light coming in with carpets and that were nested right in the workspaces. So you had to walk past these nice stairs to even get to the elevators on one side of the building. And then the other side, the typical thing, you know, where you can't get in, it's locked, it's full of smoke and cigarette butts and whatever. And you know, obviously we found that people did take the stairs more on that new innovative side. However, the disparities remain the same. So the people most likely to take the stairs, and we had to kind of figure out a methodology, so we observed. We had beam interrupter counters, but we also had to have observers so we could see who was taking the stairs. So we placed observers on the stairs, but we also placed observers at the building entrance so that we could compare the distribution, the sociodemographic distribution of the stair entrance, the building entrance, to those using the stairs. And what we found is that thinner people, white people, males, leaner people, all took the stairs more, which is basically maintaining the disparity. So again, I think, you know, as a, you know, disparities researcher, one of the things I'm particularly interested in is really having the time beyond the community guide to convene a similar group of people, what we did for the Physical Activity Guidelines Advisory Committee, and really delve into all of this and tease it apart and try to figure out what a real, what the evidence base looks like when you think about the reality of America, okay, not just people who volunteer as research subjects. And the last thing I want to say is that Rick Troiano, who is with the Department of Health and Human Services, kind of the lead staff person for the guidelines, just published an article with Russ Pate and others showing that when you use the NHANES data, and the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey data, and you took a subsample of people and objectively monitored their physical activity, the average adult got 6 to 10 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity in an entire day. 6 to 10 minutes. And I think, you know, that can kind of help us to really think about what we're doing, because if they're only getting 6 to 10 minutes and we're saying, get on out there and walk and jog, I mean, it's kind of like these two things don't add up. So, I mean, I really think that we need to think more about captive audience strategies. What are we doing in the schools? What are we doing in the workplaces? What are we doing where people are already gathered to maybe be able to roll the ball and get people to the point that they're actually motivated to do something out there?
So. All right. Drop your question. Well, again, I'd like to thank you for your attendance. I'd like to thank Penny and Tony and Jackie for their thoughtful presentations. I'll just say two things in closing. Is one is there's a lot of gaps in research, but there's also a gap in getting the research into practice, so I know many of us are interested in that. And the other gap is folks out there working in the field who are doing multitudes of things. You got to evaluate your stuff so we can have practice-based evidence as well as evidence-based practice. So there's tons of stuff for all of us to do. Let's thank our panelists again.
Hey, Mark.
Lisa's
boss.
Yeah.
Right.
How you doing?
Good.
Pleasure to meet you. I was 6.5 years. I worked under Dr. Weidmer, and when it was the Physical Activity and Health Initiative at the time.
I changed the name.
Right.
Yeah, I went from 1996 to 2003.
Right.
So I had a great time. It was a wonderful experience.
Yeah. So you're in South Carolina now.
Yeah, I've been there for a little over 5 years.
And
PRC.
Right?
Yeah, which is a good blend between, it's obviously very applied research, so it's working with the community.
Yeah.